Hi, everyone. I'm John Weigelt, National Technology Officer for Microsoft here in Canada. One of the things that I see happening across this great country of ours is that that business frame of reference has been changing. The rules of business are changing. We see Uber, Airbnb, we see connected vehicles, cars that drive themselves, changing the world around us, changing the landscape of our environment. One of the things that is important as we're looking at all these great technologies is that we have to make sure that we avoid the unintended consequences that can arise. And that means that we might need to have a little bit of a subtle adjustment, a little bit of a nudge from our traditional way of thinking, our traditional approach to security and privacy. And so this morning, I'd like to chat with you a little bit about changing that frame of reference that we've often used for security and privacy so that we can embrace these new technologies, embrace these new capabilities for not only our business, but how we learn and how we live in the world around us. I think it's very important though in the first instance is to take a look at the increasing the changing threat environment. You know, certainly we see almost on a daily basis, you know, malicious activities, hacks. We're almost confronted by the media on a regular basis around exposures that are happening. And when we look at some of the statistics, they can be rather frightening. You know, Mandiant suggests that malicious users and actors are within our networks for up to 243 days before they're detected. Now, arguably, that's the US number. I talked with the RCMP here in Canada, and they indicated that it's actually 242 days here in Canada. So a little bit better, but still not a great story. As we look at the losses that are potentially there due to malicious activities, we're talking $3 trillion is what's suggested is those losses. Now, for all of us as business leaders and security professionals, we need to double click a little bit, need to look behind the curtain to see what that number actually represents. And for the $3 trillion, when we double click on that number, we find that it's $400 billion of direct losses, and the rest are in indirect losses. Still a big number, but it helps us then understand a little bit better that, hey, this is what's happening in the marketplace. As we double click, I ask us all to double click a little further to see what's happening behind the scenes. You know, when we see the large retail exploits that are out there, you know, the point of sale terminals that happened at some of the hospitality sectors, and even Hollywood actors that are getting their accounts broken into, we need to properly attribute those exploits, those hacks, to what's actually happened. Some are insider threats, some are on traditional networks, and some are just poorly chosen passwords. You know, one of my favorite examples for malicious activities are the baby monitors or those cameras that are installed within houses where people have not put passwords in. And so if someone can log in using default passwords and be able to stream that video, that's not a hack. That's a login because they didn't have to break into the system. So one of the things as a security professional, as a privacy professional, we find that we're at that interaction, that interface between human nature, human behavior, and technology. We're almost a psychologist or anthropologist at heart. And so sometimes we as people, we try to reduce complexity in the world around us and anchor things and try to simplify the world around us by anchoring on things that we know. And sometimes that anchoring doesn't do us a great service. It really doesn't help us move and evolve with the environment. Let me give a great example. You know, when we look at November 1885, it was quite a noteworthy time in the life of Canada. 1885 in Craiglechie, BC, the Golden Spike was put in place. Now, the Golden Spike brought together this great country, created this capacity, this new business innovation, where a steam train could go across the country and connect up different businesses. Think about that as generation one of the technology innovation. Let's think about that steam train for a moment. How many people did it actually take to operate that steam engine? Well, we had an engineer that drove it, but we had a fireman that loaded the coal in and out of that big steam engine. We had someone that had to heat up that steam engine because if you heated up the boiler too quickly, it would explode. We had someone that cleaned it after the fact. We had all the mechanics that went after and helped keep that machine running. That machine was not very efficient. It was perhaps dirtier than we wanted to, fired by coal. It wasn't reliable. And there were some threats against it as well. You know, those people on horseback, those train robbers would come after that train and be able to take some of the goods and reduce the business capability. Now, if we use that frame of reference for the train in today's environment, it wouldn't really do us a good service because, hey, we're not running trains like that. If we look at Generation 2, we're all familiar with Generation 2, the diesel locomotive. Diesel locomotive had more range, We didn't have as many people that were required to operate it. It was more efficient, more productive, went faster. So we had a great Generation 2 capability that we all still understand to this day. Across Canada, we see Generation 3 coming out. So Generation 3 is the diesel electric. We have these hybrid trains, you know, more efficient, more effective, more streamlined in being able to transport our goods and services and people more and more effective and efficiently. When we think about designing our cities around these train lines, we have level crossings, we have barriers and whatnot. You know, these Generation 3, we're all very, very accustomed to here in Canada. But there's also new generations coming out. Here we have a picture of a bullet train in Japan, hundreds of kilometers an hour. The driver of this train perhaps doesn't even drive the train. They sit back and let the train drive by itself. No more level crossings, and certainly there's nobody chasing this train on horseback trying to take it over. As we start to look at these innovations, have we really adopted that frame of reference for this new generation of transportation? Have we then built that into our process? Now you're saying, John, you know, are you a model railroader? Like, why are you talking about trains? Well, how does this relate to these new technologies that we see happening out there? Well, one of the things that we've seen throughout our history at Microsoft is these evolutions or this the generation change of our data centers. We started off with Generation 1 data centers some 15 years ago, where we're delivering Hotmail to a broad community. And we bought our servers on a blade-by-blade basis. We populated those servers. We had raised flooring, much like traditional Generation 1 data centers. Had a certain power use efficiency, had a certain cost model. And you know, we operated services at scale using that model. As we started to improve and grow out our services, we got efficiencies from our suppliers. You know, we often got order of magnitude savings if instead of buying by the blade, we bought by the rack. Instead of buying by the rack, we were able to have customized locations built out for us. As we started to build out further, we went to Generation 3 data centers where we put these servers into containers. And our suppliers provided us systems on a container by container basis. So a modular style data center. We're able to get more power efficient, more energy efficient. We were able to also understand a little bit better around administration. How do you administer servers at scale? Now at Generation 4, data centers, we have componentized or containerized data centers. We have IT packs, which are self-contained data centers, some 3,000 servers within these devices. Nobody ever really has to go inside them to replace hardware components because they have a mean time between failure. It's so low, that we're able to operate and move around those servers that might fail. We don't have air cooling within those data centers. We have simply air exchange to be able to maintain the environment. And you might have seen most recently this year where we had our Microsoft research group actually drop a data center into the ocean. So our Project Natick had a smaller data center in a container that we dropped inside the ocean to see how seawater can help with cooling and perhaps even with energy generation. And so the point of all this is to talk about, you know, that existing frame of reference that we've established from time and time immemorial around our data centers. Perhaps it's time that we adjust our thinking from that Generation 2 to how hyperscale cloud providers are actually providing the service. Now, hyperscale, you say to me, well, John, hyperscale is a jargon term. What does that really mean? Well, taking a look at the Microsoft data center environment, we have 100 locations, 100 different data centers in 27 different regions. We have one of the top three networks around the world from a capacity, from a connections and a span perspective. We have over 1 million CPUs under management. And when you're running 1 million CPUs under management, you can't simply take those examples when you're running the PDP-11s, or maybe it's that old Unix server that you used to run. You can't simply run the services the same way that you were familiar with back when you were the administrator of a system. So let's take a look at some of these places where we can have those gentle nudges away from the existing status quo and away from our current frame of reference that is often had when we're looking at cloud services. The first one is around data handling. You know, isn't it great anytime you can put a slide up with laser cats? They're cats with lasers, just fantastic. What I try to represent with this slide is the fact that, you know, we all got accustomed to cloud services from the consumer or the consumer side of the house. So when we look at consumer cloud services, they have a particular license model, they have a certain agreement that you have to strike for the use of your content. Enterprise cloud services are dramatically different. Let me talk to you a little bit about the Microsoft Enterprise Cloud Services. You are always in control of your data in the Microsoft Cloud. And so that's very important. If you need to have access to it, set retention periods, you're always in control. We do not repurpose your data. We do not mine your data. And so it's important that organizations move from that existing status quo, that frame of reference around, hey, I need to give up some permission on my data, to this enterprise model where, hey, I'm always in control of my data. I never give up control of my data. So that's an important first nudge in moving to that new frame of reference. A second frame of reference is around operations. You know, I started off my career in doing Unix system administration, and I remember that Unix box that I had underneath my desk, and I was administrator of that device and was able to have permission for everything. Set the backups, set permissions for users, be able to see everything that was happening on that device. You simply can't take those operations that you used to do on one system and multiply them to a million physical servers under management. Not to mention that when you go to virtual environments, the multiplying factor that's there. You simply cannot manage those systems at scale. When we talk to Canadian organizations around their ratio between administrators and servers, so how many servers does every administrator manage? We hear anywhere from one administrator for 80 servers or one administrator for 300 servers. What's the top line? And I really have to check in on that person again because I think the number was a little bit off. At Microsoft, we have one administrator for 3,000 servers. And so you can appreciate when you're administrating 3,000 physical servers and all the virtual environments on it, there's not a lot of time to be casually browsing, even if you had the opportunity to do so. And so most of the operations that we do in the Microsoft cloud are automated. So those simple first line, second line support automated controls where people do not need to get involved with activities or moderation of those activities. And so that's really, really important when you start to look at how to run the services. You know, first off, services are automated. You know, they're automated so that people do not have to get involved because you simply can't run services at scale if people are involved. Secondly, where there are requirements for access to customer tenant. This is generally in the third line support area. Those are driven by customer requirements, so trouble ticket driven. You have multiple factors of authentication, so something you have, something you know, something uniquely you. They're monitored and approved by a two-key system. We have a lockbox system where a manager actually has to approve and recognize that that individual is able to gain access to that particular data. So what does this look like? Let me talk to you a little bit about lockbox and then follow on customer lockbox. So as I said, most activities are automated. So an engineer doesn't necessarily need to gain access for first line and second line support. But sometimes on the rare occasion where third line support is required, we have a workflow process to make sure there's a two-key system to ensure that no one individual has access to a customer tenant on their own. This two-key system is called lockbox. And what Lockbox does is it uses the trouble ticketing system to respond to customer complaints or customer concerns. It assigns then that customer concern to an engineer. That engineer logs into this workflow process and requests permission to gain access to resolve that particular fault or challenge that resides. After the engineer asks for access, it gets routed through to a Microsoft manager that makes sure that there's a trouble ticket associated with that request for access and that that engineer is indeed the person that is authorized to get access. And then that manager approves that access to that system. Now that system access is least privilege. So the engineer can only do the function that's been assigned to them. They can't color outside the lines and go off to another customer tenant or do something completely dramatically different than it was asked for in the trouble ticket. It's time bound. And so we have something within our system called zero standing privilege. At any one time in Office 365, there are no standing administrators. And so that engineer, in order to gain access, needs to be given that administrator access for that period of time. And it's just in time, so it's time bound. If you're not finished the function within, let's say, 4 hours, then you get locked out and you have to ask again. And finally, it's heavily audited. And so we have that oversight to ensure that people aren't doing things that they weren't expected, and we can review their actions to make sure that they only did what was expected. So this is a great workflow process that we've built in by default within our Office 365 cloud services. But customers asked us for a little bit more transparency, a little bit more oversight. And so we're quite pleased that we've announced that we have now what's called customer lockbox. We've included the customer in the conversation. And so the workflow starts much as it does with the regular lockbox. Trouble ticket comes in, it's assigned to an engineer. The engineer goes into the workflow process in order to get a sense of, you know, what I need to do or what the engineer needs to do. A manager then reviews that request and ensures that it's a valid request. They then look to provide that access, but we've included the customer now within that conversation. And through the customer administration portal, the customer is notified that there's been a request for access to their customer tenant. The customer can then take a look and say, yes, I put in this request. Yes, this is for valid data on this tenant. And then they can approve or deny that request. And that goes for all those engineer and administrator requests into the customer tenant. A great new feature that enables our customers to have oversight and insight into what's happening within their particular tenant. That's just one example of some of the many security features that we have within the Microsoft Cloud. We take a full end-to-end approach for security in the Microsoft Cloud. We start right off at the physical grounds of our data centers. And when you drive up to one of the facilities and see the fences that go around and the vehicle traps and the personnel traps, we have full security zoning where we have public zone, reception zone, operation zone, high security zones. We have multi-factor authentication that goes between those zones. We actually have personnel traps that go in between our operation zone and our reception zone, and they weigh people as they come in and out of the facilities. And so that we know if they're leaving with equipment that they didn't come in with or have a difference in what they brought into the facility. You're only allowed in the facility with the facility's clearance request. And so you can't simply go in and visit for a looky-loo. You have to be properly authorized to be able to go there. We check for wireless access points. The controls from the physical side are world-class. We have data controls, network controls, denial of service protection controls. This layered defense goes throughout the data centers, through to the data, through to the administrative environments. We really pay close attention to how we deliver those services and make sure that they're fully resilient and redundant. You know, one of the things that often comes up is this idea of a physical service bias. We have this as people like to connect and say, hey, I have my server, I have my storage, I have my terminal, everything on one particular environment. The world has changed a great deal, has it not? Virtualized everything, virtualized storage, virtualized processing, virtualized displays. Everything is virtualized these days. And so we need to be able to shift our thinking from these physical type environments into this virtual environment. You know, something as straightforward as business continuity. I recall cutting my teeth on business continuity with hot standbys, cold standbys in different sites. Today's world is continuous service delivery, continuously resilient. If you go to do your online banking, you expect it to be there, regardless of platform, regardless of device, regardless of location. So downtime is a thing of the past. And so the Microsoft Cloud Services provide you that resilience on a geographical basis around the world. One of the things that often comes up around data protection is encryption. You know, how do you encrypt the data? You know, we employ encryption throughout our data centers, not only in transit, so as the information is coming and going from our data centers, but also in rest, at rest and storage. And so we use the advanced encryption standard for transport layer security for data coming to and from our data centers. We use BitLocker disk encryption for all our disks to make sure that, hey, if that disk goes awry, that your information is always protected. We include file-based encryption in Office 365 for SharePoint, for OneDrive for Business, for Skype. And we're including additional encryption throughout the environments. You can actually bring your own key to a hardware security module within the Microsoft Cloud so that you own and control your keys. So encryption goes throughout the environment. We also make sure that we continue that protection throughout the detect, respond, recover operations phase. And we have the operational security assurance environment that ensures that our controls, our processes, are always there to help secure your data and protect your information. This continuous process always looks at how we can improve the security and operations and resilience of our environment and your data. We have industry-leading groups like the Cyber Crime Center, like the Cyber Defense Operations Center. These groups collect information from the 600 million Windows machines that run their malicious software removal tool, our scanning tools on a monthly basis. They use the Bing search engine to be able to determine, you know, spoofing sites, the phishing sites, the drive-by download sites. We collect that information and we're able to safeguard our cloud services based upon the intelligence from our worldwide networks. We share that intelligence on a regular basis through our cyber threat information feeds or advanced threat analytics, and we have annual summaries, biannual summaries in the Microsoft Security Intelligence reports. And for those of us here in Canada, you can dig deep and dive into the Canadian numbers and see what's happening on a Canadian perspective. So having that global view and perspective on the data and what's happening in cyberspace is an important value add within the cloud services and gives you that 360 view of what's happening in cyberspace. And not only that, we're actively taking down the botnets and pursuing some of the malfeasance that are out there to make sure that we're cleaning up that malicious activity that's out there on the web. Now that really covered a lot of the security techniques and controls. There's far more information available through our trust centers that describes all those security controls in fine grained detail. That was just a snapshot. We also take privacy very seriously. You know, we started on this trustworthy computing endeavor in 2002 and have been continuously building security within our product set. 2 years after we launched the security development lifecycle, we included privacy within that process. And so privacy by design, in deployment, by default, and in communications has been part of our DNA for the better part of over 10 years now. And so our worldwide approach to privacy is informed by local policies. When we look at PIPEDA or the provincial privacy legislation, be they the health privacy or municipal privacy, that informs our global approach so that you're able to have control, consent, notice, choice, build those features in for not only your employees, but onwards to those customers. We were the first cloud provider to be certified against ISO 27018, the cloud privacy standard. And Canadian experts have reviewed that cloud privacy standard against Canadian legislation and found that it exceeds the requirements of Canadian federal and provincial legislation. So you can rest assured that your information is held safe and private within the Microsoft cloud. Now, you can take my word for it, or you can take the independent review word for it. We spend a lot of time and place a lot of emphasis on international compliance. We have third-party attestations for our ISO 27001, that's the Information Security Management Standard, SSE 16, SOC 1 and SOC 2, the PCI card, Payment Card Industry Standards. We have a number of certifications that our cloud goes through to make sure that you have a third-party voice attesting to the fact that we do things in the proper way, we do what we claim to do. And so we publish those reports out on our trust centers on the Microsoft Cloud Web Properties Office 365 in Azure. So you're able then to use those reports to gain that assurance within your environment. We're also committed to transparency, letting people know what's happening out there in cyberspace, letting people know how we respond to requests for information so that you have insight in how do we behave in response to these concerns. And so we publish on our transparency hub, you know, what we see happening, well, those requests that we receive for data, either from law enforcement or for governments, and on a biannual basis, you can see how many requests we receive. If we look at the last report that we published that covered the first half of 2015, we saw that we received some 36,000 requests from law enforcement for data from law enforcement around the world. Now, the majority of those requests were for consumer data. So think of Xbox Live, think of Hotmail. These can largely be anonymous accounts. They're free. They can almost be throwaway accounts. And you know, often, as much as we try to prevent and preclude people that are doing criminal activities from using those services, from time to time, they creep in and we support law enforcement in those requests for data. Out of those 36,000 plus requests, we had 6 requests for enterprise data. Now we commit to redirecting those requests for enterprise data back to the enterprise customer. So the first thing that we do, our first response is to say to whoever requests that data from the government and law enforcement side, please talk to the customer. We are not in control of that data. Talk to the enterprise customer. Where we're not able to redirect the request, we will vigorously defend our customers' rights to protect their privacy. And we're taking those requests to court. And so one of those 6 requests we're actually contesting within the courts. Now there were 2 requests that we responded in a fashion that allowed us to provide some information to law enforcement. Now those that information that was provided were generally because of wholly criminal activities. And so either someone had set up a tenant that was doing stock fraud or perhaps other illegal activities, it was clear that notifying the customer would tip off for that particular criminal exercise. I invite you to take a look at the Transparency Hub that sees the description of all those types of activities. We've also opened up transparency centers. So this continues on our activities around the government security program, providing access to our source code for governments around the world so that they can make sure that nothing untoward is happening behind the scenes. You know, there's a lot of speculation that's out there around backdoors or surreptitious access to data. You know, the Transparency Center and our government security program provides governments the ability to look behind the covers to make sure that there's nothing untoward happening behind the scenes. Now, when it talks about compliance, you know, a lot of times customers will say, hey, you know, I have this particular compliance requirement. I have this particular need to be able to look against my control objectives. You know, one of the things that we do is we look to try to incorporate all those control objectives from internationally recognized standards. And we collect them in what we call a master controls list. So for Office 365, we have over 900 controls that we track and be able to map against individual requirements and guides. And so as we look towards the global marketplace and individual standards or guidance that's been described, we find that there's a strong affinity, a strong overlap between those third-party attestations we have and the controls that our customers are asking for. And so as we go and work with our customers to gain assurance in the cloud, we work with them to show that mapping and demonstrate the full coverage of their compliance requirements against those that we track in our service. Now, sometimes we find that these threats that are out there, this constant barrage of exploits and incidents that we see in the media are causing organizations to retrench themselves. Going back to the old castle in the moat model, and here we have a slide of pikemen that used to protect the castle from the malfeasance and the people that would choose to overrun it. As we look at today's computing environment, it's a networked environment. We simply cannot afford to have the castle in the moat environment. We need to look at protecting our data and having a staged approach so we can no longer rely upon those approaches that we used to take before we were as connected and as omnipresent as we are today within our corporate network environments. And so it's important that when we look to transform the way that we do our business through the use of technology, that we also help our IT security community transform. Now, I cut my teeth on snort and shadow logs way back in the day when we were looking at incident response and intrusion detection. Maybe today I don't need to sift through those logs as often as I used to. Maybe I can rely upon my cloud provider to manage all that noise, the normal network hygiene stuff, so that I can focus my team on the more nefarious, the low and the slow stuff, or perhaps it's the business logic failures that occur from those threats. So as we start to look at protecting our environments in this new modern age, we can look at different approaches to helping our security people keep ahead of those threats. So what's an organization to do in their move to the cloud? Well, how do you get comfortable? We've worked with organizations across Canada in trying to get comfortable with the cloud, and those that have moved have followed largely these steps that we have listed up on this slide. I think the first thing to do, be very, very specific around the service that you're making use of in the cloud. You know, the cloud in the Microsoft parlance is over 200 different services. It can become overwhelming for a security or privacy practitioner to look at all the potential use cases. So be very, very specific about that use case in the cloud. Second thing is, look at your compliance environment. I'm a simple engineer. I can't tell you about all the different rules and regulations that your particular business has to follow. So look at that compliance environment and understand, you know, all those checkboxes that you need to have in those controls. Next thing is to take a look at your as-is environment. How are you doing business today? A lot of times people don't look at their server closet or their existing practices. Take a look at how you're doing business today and see if there's any gaps that the cloud can help you transform and provide assurance for. Conduct a privacy impact assessment and a threat risk assessment. These are great tools that help you get insight and visibility into the risks and the threats that are out there in your environment. Or even better yet, conduct a delta. Take those existing risk assessments that you have today and look at how the cloud will improve those risk assessments as you move forward. Pilot the service. You know, there's free trials that are readily available. Take a look at the administrative console, the legal discovery console, the audit console. Take a look at all those great tools that are available to help you with your business. Next three steps are around making the business case. You know, understand the business risk, understand the service level agreements, understand the residual privacy impact assessment. Bring those all together, and we think you'll find that there's a strong case that can be made for going to the cloud, not only from a financial perspective, but also from a business, from a security and privacy perspective. Finally, roll out those services and start enjoying the use of the cloud. So there you've seen very, very rapidly how the world is transforming due to technology, and how we as security and privacy practitioners need to have a gentle nudge to be able to address these new threats, a gentle nudge to be able to rethink and re-anchor on this new way of doing business. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your time today and point you towards the Microsoft Cloud websites where you can get more information.